BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. All too often on this programme, we have to dwell on the tough employment climate for visually impaired people here in the UK. So it's good, as we approach Christmas, to have a positive story to tell. Sandy Wozner is thought to be the UK's first female visually impaired CEO. She runs the Employment Network for Equality and Inclusion, which has ties with some of the country's biggest employers. She radiates positivity now, but it hasn't always been plain sailing. Well, I've been talking to Sandy about her life and career, where, as well as her successes, she talks about the losing of her sight and its initial effect on her, almost derailing that career. But she began by telling me more about the company which she currently runs.
We are a diversity, equality and inclusion charity, and we work with organisations of all shapes and sizes across the public, private and third sector to support them in making their organisations more diverse and inclusive. We provide training, consultancy and e-learning services, and we focus on the UK, but we support organisations that are global, but usually from a UK base, because UK employment legislation is quite specific.
You say it's from kind of all sort of sizes of companies, but sure. Is it mainly the larger companies that you deal with?
You'd be surprised. You know, we do work with some large companies, but we also work with small organizations that care about creating a fantastic workplace for their employees. So it's organizations of like really small, so micro-organizations to large multinationals. It's incredible the range of organizations that we work with and how important it is to those organizations to have the right culture and to have the right setup so that they're giving their employees everything they need to thrive.
Now, you'll be aware of the depressingly low figures of visually impaired people of working age who actually have a job.
Yep.
And of the recent parliamentary group report, which pointed out that, you know, almost half of employers had no accessible form of job application and that one in four weren't prepared to make any reasonable adjustments to employ blind people. In other words, the implication being these low figures were because employers wouldn't employ people. Do you think that's a major reason for these persistently low employment figures, or is it something else?
I think it's a mix of things. I think to me that would probably be a bit simplistic. It's ignorance. So people, well, the employers that you've just suggested, not really understanding what it means to employ a blind or partially sighted person and being in fear of it and thinking that reasonable adjustments are really expensive, which they are not, but also the whole cycle of blind people or people with visual impairments struggling in the education system, struggling to get into work at all, struggling to be part of the labor force. So, you know, when you're looking at people in organizations who are blind and partially sighted, yeah, it's 25% of people are in employment, which is tiny, but it's also even more complicated than that because those people aren't progressing into leadership roles either. It is a bit of a perfect storm. So, you know, it's the level of discrimination people face, lack of understanding, and lack of resources to be able to actually put this right, despite lots of charities out there trying to support people with sight loss.
Do you use your own experience when you're trying to persuade people that this is a good idea, companies, big or small?
Yes, sometimes I'm not involved in every single pitch or every single level of engagement with people. I guess I would say it's really important that I get profiled and people understand that, you know, I'm a CEO, I'm blind, I've got ADHD, I'm a woman. And so, you know, it's really, really important that people understand that someone like me is perfectly capable of being a leader and doing all the wonderful things I get to do with my life. So, you know, we do absolutely shout about the fact that I am the CEO of ENEI.
Right. So let's go back to the beginning. How did you get to be UK's only visually impaired female CEO? You weren't born here, were you?
No, I was born in Toronto.
So what brought you over here?
Boyfriend at the time, not currently married to him, married to somebody else who I've been with for now almost 30 years.
What was the state of your vision when you arrived here?
So I have retinitis pigmentosa. So it was kind of early, no night vision, no peripheral vision. I was 27 when I came here. And when I was 25, I stopped driving because I drove into a parked car. So my peripheral vision wasn't particularly good. I thought maybe it's time to stop driving. So, you know, I had no night vision, no peripheral vision. But I was you know, I was in denial. You know, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa when I was 15. So I knew that I was going to lose my sight eventually, but I didn't really understand. There wasn't that much that was understood about it at the time. And so I just kind of got on with it. And I dealt with the lack of night vision and lack of peripheral vision probably for longer than I should have.
So what was your first job here? And was the lack of vision a factor in that, or hadn't it got that bad then?
No, not at all. It was just night vision and peripheral vision, so my central vision was fine. So there was no impact other than me just sort of going into bars and talking to people's belly buttons and things like that at night. But work-wise, you know, it was fine. I trained as an accountant, so I started work here as a production accountant and film production. I spent most of my career in the media sector, so I started out for a company called Limelight. It was a film production company, so they did movies and TV shows and commercials and music videos, that kind of stuff.
So did you stay in accountancy in the media world, or did you get seduced by the excitement and bright lights of the media?
I didn't get seduced. I was seduced, but I was an accountant. You know, no one, I think, saw me as being a creative. Although before I trained as an accountant, I went to art school, which is a good thing I didn't pursue that career now that I'm blind. But I'm actually very creative. And accountancy was just something to do. I'm Jewish, and so I came from a family where there were three careers. There was a doctor, lawyer, accountant. So there you go. And I worked my way up. So I went to another film production company as financial controller, then another one as finance director, and then I ended up at the Sci-Fi UK TV channel and eventually left there as CFO and COO. And then I ended up leaving there, when I had my son. So, God, how long ago was that? 26 years ago. And took some time out to be with my son, and then ended up working in marketing. Stayed in accountancy and eventually moved away from accountancy and moved into sort of COO type roles.
Would you call yourself ambitious?
Yes. Absolutely. When I was younger, I was ambitious for all sorts of things I don't care about now. I was ambitious for money, power, status. I had quite a dysfunctional childhood. So I was trying to, I suppose, prove something to my parents, but I was trying to prove something. And I achieved all of this status and I achieved these things. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's not what I thought it was going to be like. It didn't really do anything for me. And then when I lost my sight, so I registered blind in 2008. And after that, I started to realize, actually, I wanted to do something different. I needed to find the thing that gave me meaning, that gave me purpose. And that's how I ended up in the charity sector. Now I'm ambitious for the work. I don't care about status, money, power, any of it. What I care about is doing something meaningful and useful and hopefully leaving the world a little better than I came into it and wanting to do something purposeful with my life. And that makes me happy. It was losing my sight that actually made me happy. I'm a much happier person now, having found my purpose and having found something that really makes me feel useful.
It's interesting. I mean, that was going to be my next question. When did sight begin to be a factor in your search for a job? And I suppose initially I meant a bad factor, but it sounds as if, oddly, it was a good factor in the end.
Well, it was a bad factor because I still got totally discriminated against. So when I decided that I wanted to leave what was then my business, so my husband and I were running a digital agency, and we ran that together for 7 years, but I'd been doing some work with government. I was working on the e-accessibility action plan, which I co-wrote with someone in the DCMS. And I was part of the accessibility forum. This was back in 2010, 2011. And I'd been doing that work, lots of pro bono work with government, lots of stuff with charities around accessibility of technology, accessibility in general for disabled people. So I was quite interested in all of that. So by the time that I decided to go and work for a charity, which was end up in 2014, and we closed our agency, I then went out to look for a job, and boy, was I discriminated against. I had no idea as to just how nasty that was going to be. It was really tough. I got rejected from jobs that I was perfectly suited for and so on. So it took, one charity to be able to say, yeah, we think you're terrific, and the fact that you're blind is actually an asset.
What was the worst example of discrimination that you experienced?
It wasn't overt, it was covert, but I was going for a job and it was through a recruiter. And so I had the interview set up at like 9 o'clock one morning, and I realized that I hadn't told the recruiter that I was blind. So I phoned the recruiter up the day before and said, by the way, I just want to let you know I'm blind. Well, I was meeting someone in a restaurant. And so I said, look, I'm going to be the person with the white cane. You know, miraculously, at 8 o'clock the following morning, the meeting got canceled and was going to be, quote unquote, rescheduled, never was. So things like that happen quite often. Mm.
Just want to talk to you a bit about one key access issue. You co-authored the 10 Principles of Inclusive Web Design. There are still multiple examples of inaccessible or, at the very least, really difficult web designs for visually impaired people. What would it take to make a real impact on this problem?
Well, people caring, I suppose.
I mean, is it legislation? I mean, after all, it doesn't really work to ask people nicely, does it, to do it?
No. Well, I mean, there is legislation, you know, the Equality Act. It just doesn't have teeth. And, you know, this has been going for a very long time. And, well, the onus of responsibility ends up being on the individual who's discriminated against to, you know, take an organization to court. Nobody's really going to do that because nobody can afford to do that. But, you know, the 10 principles of inclusive web design, I wrote when I was running an agency, just out of frustration and looking at, okay, how can other web design agencies or digital agencies look at creating more accessible environments for anybody, you know, not just visually impaired people, but any disabled person or just anybody, because inclusive design is just good design. It's good for everyone. I'd written the e-accessibility action plan for government, which was an initial iteration of those principles. There were the 7 principles of design, which I used from CABE, that what was the Center of Accessibility for the Built Environment, which no longer exists. And they had some principles for architecture. And I thought, these look really interesting. Let's take these into the web. But I extended them to 10 when I realized actually it needed to be more. You know, it's a slow burn. There's plenty of people out there doing really great work on making technology accessible, but it just does not appear to be important to businesses.
I'm going to do a bit of a swift hand turn here. I'm just interested, how did you cope with gradually failing sight? Because you did know it was going to happen.
Yeah, badly. Knowing something like that is going to happen and it actually happening. Yeah, never the twain shall meet. These are two very different things. I coped really badly. I had a nervous breakdown. I completely hit the wall. It took me a couple of years. I was extremely unwell. My mental health was extremely poor. My mental health is phenomenal now. And I had to do a lot of work to get myself well. I didn't want to live. I didn't want to wake up in the morning. I thought, who am I? I was just Sandy one day, and the next day I was Sandy the blind, Sandy the disabled, and that completely freaked me out. The practical stuff was easy. The psychological stuff and the stuff around my identity was really, really challenging. You know, who am I as a mother? Who am I as a wife? Who am I as a worker? Who am I? Like, I just have no idea.
Can you define what got you out of it?
Gosh, a really great support network, friends and family, and an incredible therapist. Yeah, mainly. And other things, like I meditate every day now and other things. But that, I'd say, was the crux. Probably my husband over everyone. Why on earth he's still with me is beyond me. I pushed everyone away, including him. And he stuck around. God bless him. He's an amazing man.
You used to have cane rage, I believe.
Yeah.
What annoyed you most? What was most likely to bring it on?
So when I first started using a cane, I wasn't using a long cane. I was using one of those tapping canes. And I still had some sight. And I saw the way people looked at me. And it was a mix of pity or anger or fear. And that was just the worst because they just didn't care. People just didn't care. They'd kick the cane. They didn't care. I was an invalid. I was invalid. I was a lesser human being suddenly. And that made me hurt. Yeah, it was really tough. I was really angry for quite a while. This was all in the same period of time where I wasn't well. But I was extremely angry. I don't have cane rage anymore.
Right. But were there particular things that brought it on?
Well, so, like, for example, I went to Brent Cross, where I was living in North London. I went to Brent Cross with my husband and my son. And I was walking with the cane. And this woman tripped over the cane and turned around. I won't swear, but I will bleep myself out. Turned around and said to me, "Why don't you F off, you effing blind bee?" That was fun. Yeah.
That was fun. Yeah.
That was fun. And I was so horrified. We all stopped because everyone just sort of stopped in their tracks. Like, what on earth was that? And these two women behind me just, they sort of reached out and grabbed me and they just said, "I'm so sorry you had to experience that. That was disgusting." And that was probably the worst. But people would kick my cane and just like look at me as if I was like, I shouldn't be there. You know, I started to think, well, really, you know, do you think I should be in an institution somewhere, you know, not visible to, you know, normal people, because obviously I am not normal anymore. How other people viewed me, and still, I mean, still do, except I'm not angry about it now. But other people really make some assumptions about who I am and what I'm capable of. And, you know, that was at the time unexpected. I did not understand how I was going to be discriminated against. So that's why I'm saying, like, you know, the idea of losing your sight and losing your sight, the practical bit is almost straightforward. It happens. You got to deal with it. The psychological stuff, like who you are, what your identity is, who you are in the world, and how people look at you, I was just unexpected. And I found that really, really hard to come to terms with, but I have.
And I think the cane range has gone now. You now see ignorance as opportunity?
I see it as an opportunity to educate. So anybody who, you know, asks me about my site, or, you know, a lot of the time it's, you know, because I take Ubers everywhere, it's my Uber driver is like, oh, where are you going? You know, I'm going to work. Oh, do you work? Wow, that's amazing. What do you do? I'm a chief executive, you know. And so I just take everything as an opportunity to educate, because, you know, anger doesn't help. If you're angry, what you're going to do is alienate people. So if I'm not angry, and if I'm willing to educate, and some people aren't, you know, I hear people with different protected characteristics or blind people who are saying, look, I don't see it as my job to educate. I do. So I see this as my mission, crusade, whatever, that every single person I come into contact with who is ignorant and doesn't understand what it means to be blind, I'm going to do my best to educate them. I think that's the only thing I can do.
Isn't it quite hard for people to patronize a CEO?
Yeah, but they do a good job of it. I mean, people do. It's incredible. People make assumptions. People make assumptions about what you're capable of because you're blind. And so I guess I see it as an opportunity to say, hey, you know, what you thought I was capable of is not, and to demonstrate that, find my way through to making them think, that wasn't what I expected a blind person to be like.
Why do you think you are the only one, i.e. the only visually impaired woman
female
CEO?
Yeah. Because there's just not enough of us out there. There's not enough of us in the workforce. So there's definitely the issue of pipeline, is that blind people are far too far from the labor market. And then once they're there, they get discriminated against. So they're not rising into leadership positions. And I'd like to do something about that.
You're in a position to do something about it now.
I know.
Are there a couple of things you think, if they changed, those figures might change?
Remove discrimination, remove ignorance. I mean, it's usually people's attitudes. They're really fearful of it. It's like, oh my God, how do I work with a blind person? Like, they're just so afraid. And it's their own fear. It's their own thinking, what would happen if I lost my sight? Like, how would I cope? And people impose that on other people. I am hoping that things will improve with technology, that things will improve with attitudes and social change. So we definitely are seeing more disabled people in public spaces, in the workplace, on television, and so on. And, you know, hopefully we will begin to see social change generationally. I think that a lot of people have unconscious biases, so they have attitudes towards things they don't even realize they have. It's not going to be fast. Mm. You know, social change is about changing hearts and minds. It's about changing attitudes, and that you just got to keep going at that. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I've got to fight the fight. I mean, you know, I do this job, and hopefully that means the reach can be to a much wider audience and more people who understand actually that, you know, being blind isn't a death sentence. It just means I can't see. I can do a whole bunch of other things. I'm ambitious for the work now, and that feels right to me. I'm an introvert anyhow. So, you know, I don't like the attention to be on me, but what I like the attention to be on the work, and the work is really important.
Well, I apologize for putting the attention on you.
It's fine. I can handle it.
Sandy Wasmer, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Absolutely lovely to meet you.
And that's it for today, but more positivity next week and some Christmas Eve surprises. I'm not going to tell you what they are, otherwise they wouldn't be surprises, would they? From me, Peter White, and producer Beth Hemmings, goodbye.